Okay, when I was asked to give the talk, I had to come up with a title. Sometimes that's the hardest thing to do. Jules Janik, many of you know, he's one of my favorite colleagues at Purdue, said a title is very important. If your title's apples, you better talk about everything related to apples. If it's the effect of glyphosate on killing peach trees, that's a little more specific. So I said trials. I really haven't had that many trials. I look at trials as the experiments that we've done and the interactions I've had with people in international tribulations. Well, I think that there's some young people in this audience, maybe some graduate students. I think tribulations are interpretation of the data and writing the papers, but that's also a lot of fun because you interact with a lot of people. And then the lessons. I learned a lot more, I think, than anybody I interacted with in the international arena from them. And I'm going to talk about why I view that as being very important to make international research, developmental research successful. As Matthew mentioned, Purdue offered a retirement incentive in January. I applied for it, and I got it. So as of June 30th, I retired, and so now I'm emeritus. There were three of us that were retired, and at the retirement luncheon, the other two got plaques that didn't say emeritus, but mine did. So I guess I was special. And the other thing I should say about being hired straight out of my PhD program from North Carolina State, George will attest to this, George Wilson. It's a great university, fantastic weed science program. But in 1980, a lot of horticulture departments were hiring weed scientists, so we didn't have to do postdocs. So that was good. So I was raised in Michigan, a little town in southwestern Michigan, Niles, Michigan, 7 miles north of Indiana. I now live in Indiana part of the year. I live in Michigan part of the year. But as I tell my sons, I'm not a Hoosier, but you are. You got to be a Hoosier to appreciate that. I went to Central Michigan University. I got a BS in biology. You understand that, Lori. The Ohio State University, which also has the best football team in the country, by the way, even though they lost to Oklahoma. Pomology with Dave Ferree. Many of you probably know Dave. I know Kurt does. And my PhD was with Tom Monaco and Walt Scraw at North Carolina State University. Matthew mentioned a few countries, and I'm just going to quickly go through these. My USAID-funded projects primarily have been in Central America and Africa. But in Central America, our primary work is in Honduras and Guatemala. But I've done a lot of work in El Salvador, some in Ecuador, and some in Nicaragua under the IPM CRISP. And then I did a special assignment under the IPM CRISP in Ukraine shortly after the Soviet Union broke up because we were looking at opportunities to help them with their agriculture as they transitioned into independence. Mexico, this was an interesting project because I worked with an ag economist, Glenn Sullivan, and we grow a lot of muskmelons in southern Indiana, and they taste a whole lot better than those things that come from California. Sorry, Beth. And his idea was that we would grow muskmelons in Monterey area of Mexico, Indiana muskmelons, and import them into Indiana in the winter because we have all these storage facilities that are just sitting idle. And we actually were able to grow the melons and come up with production programs that worked. But you know what happened? We couldn't get them into the country. And I won't talk about the politics of that. I've done quite a bit of work in China with research types of work, not so much development work, but research with past postdocs and graduate students. I was the chair of our graduate committee for many years at Purdue, and we went to Russia, Czech Republic, and Hungary to do a student recruiting program. And my wife is still mad at me about that trip because she said one time, I really want to go to Russia and go to St. Petersburg. And I said, I never care if I ever go to Russia. And then I went to Russia and went to St. Petersburg and Moscow. And if you haven't ever been to St. Petersburg, go. It's fantastic. Have you been there, George?
No, I've only been to Venice.
Well, St. Peter the Great loved Venice. So he designed St. Petersburg on Venice with all the waterways. He forgot one thing. The waterways freeze in the winter. There's a few left now, but most of them are roads, but beautiful area. I've done study abroad comparing organic and conventional agriculture in Italy, France, and UK with undergraduate students from Purdue. And then in Uganda, South Sudan, Israel, Jordan, Palestine, these were Purdue University. I guess some people would call them exploratory trips to see how we could help with certain universities and certain NGOs that worked in those countries that came to Purdue and asked for agricultural assistance. South Sudan was an interesting trip. I don't know how many have been to South Sudan. I was there in November of 2013. I left the second week, and the third week, the civil war started. And so that project, although it had a lot of potential, never got off the ground because it's not someplace you want to be now, right, George? Yeah. They have international highways there. They're one-lane dirt roads. Were you on those? Yeah. We would make about 50 kilometers a day because it also rains a lot there. And they have semis and every kind of vehicle you can imagine on those roads. I work in Nigeria at the present time with IITA on a Gates-funded project on cassava. And it's actually weed management of cassava, back to my training. And then the AIV project that Matthew mentioned in Kenya, Tanzania, and Zambia. And I like to tell the story that I started off killing weeds, now I'm eating them. So some of my perspectives, and I know there's some young people here. How many people in the audience have never had any international experience, but they want to become involved in international activity? Oh, okay. All right, well, this is some of my comments here will be directed to you. At the session we had yesterday, John Bowman was asked, how do you get involved in international activities? Well, my history is, I call it serendipity. In 1982, Ed Tigelar, any of you remember him, tomato breeder from Purdue, came to me and he said, there's a tomato project that I think we can get funded by USDA in Honduras to help them in the Comayagua Valley grow tomatoes. And we need you because their major weed problem is purple nutsedge. And they'd all gone to California. That was back in the day when tomatoes were direct seeded. And they decided they would direct seed tomatoes into heavy populations of purple nutsedge. So my job was to tell them how to minimize purple nutsedge, completely eliminating their crop. And the first thing we said was transplants. And then we had a few herbicides that kind of worked. But that project was about a year and a half project, and we wrote a tomato production guide for Honduras, which I think they're still using. But then beyond that, in the late 80s, we were approached by Virginia Tech, who was the lead on the IPM CRISP, and they wanted Purdue to be a partner with them, so we got involved in that. And then the other things have become opportunities because, to me, if you want to get started, the first thing you do is, if you're at a university, talk to people. You'll be amazed the number of people that are involved in some kind of international activity. If you don't want to do that, almost every university, not just land-grant universities, but small private universities, medium-sized universities, almost all universities have some type of international program. And they have some person that's a director of this. Go talk to those people and find out what's available. Go on the web. There's NGOs, non-government organizations. There's religious organizations throughout the country that are involved in various aspects that may need people to go on volunteer trips. You meet people. You get connected. There may be jobs. There may be fellowships, things like that. So it's really important communication-wise. If you're a young faculty member, go talk to somebody involved in international work because they're always looking for somebody to help them. And that's how I got involved, that weeds are always a problem. When I went into Honduras, there was an entomologist there, and he said, weeds aren't a problem. What are you doing here? I said, how do you eliminate them? He said, well, we haul them out. I said, well, eventually you want to have people to haul them out. And that's what we definitely see in Africa now. Labor shortage in Africa to haul weeds. So those are some ideas. You can go online and look at USDA, USAID. Matthew, NIFA has an international activities program. Lots and lots of opportunities. So talk to people. Get connected. Talk to George Wilson. Talk to Beth. Talk to John. John has a whole talk on how you get involved, don't you, John? What are the areas of need? Almost every funding organization or NGO has an agenda. Find out what their agenda is. If it's of interest to you, then further investigate it. The Hort Innovation Lab is based on horticulture crops, right? So if you're interested in horticulture crops, do it. Funding sources, I think that just follows along with finding out who is involved and what is involved. There's also Rockefeller Foundation, there's Gates Foundation, things like that. They often send out special invitations for solicited proposals or pre-proposals that you can then become involved in. Proposal writing and success, that's important. You got to write the proposal based on what they're asking for, but you've all written proposals, you know that. But if you're just getting started, work with somebody that has a lot of experience on that. But the things that I found important in international work that do require attention regardless, gender issues. Horticulture crops throughout the world have often been referred to as women's crops. Women are very important in producing horticulture crops in the developing world. So you have to address that. And they're oftentimes not rewarded as fully as they should be by all the work that they do because of gender conflicts and things. Scalability. What are you doing? Is it scalable to practicality? That's important. What are the development opportunities? The other thing, if you're working in a country, visit with the USAID missions, if you can get in. But you can work with John there. If you're involved in a project, he can help you in certain areas. Look for the right collaborations. The most important thing in international work is, you may say my U.S. colleagues, the most important thing are your host country colleagues. If you don't have good host country colleagues, your project will fail. Because I go to Kenya 3-4 times a year. What happens? And I'm there for maybe 10 days, 2 weeks. What happens the rest of the year if you don't have good people doing the job? So it's important. And then look at how you can have outreach and extension programs for the farmers or the target audiences. And capacity building. That's the one thing that's critical, is making sure that when you leave with people that have gained from the experience with you, because they're going to be there from day to day. The societal impacts are important. How have you helped move that pendulum forward for people that have been disadvantaged? And this is critical as far as I'm concerned. We always talk about sustainability capacity building and things like that. If the government does not buy into your programs, when you leave, your program may go backwards in time. And that's critical. And in a lot of developing world countries, that's a big obstacle. So if you're going to become involved in a country, get to know people in the government, the Ministry of Agriculture, finance ministers, things like that. Maybe you can't see them directly, but you can see some of their assistants. Impress them, and they'll come and see you. And I'll give you an example of that about Guatemala. And then there's always this question about what is the benefit of what you do in Africa to the U.S.? Well, in AIVs, we're going to help Americans become healthier in their eating habits because they are nutrient-rich plants that actually taste pretty good. And then when you're developing your production, you have to think about when you're writing the proposal, What are the needs, the gaps to be addressed, and a participatory approach. That goes back to having good collaborators. U.S. members are important because if you have to have an economist, you have to have a pest management person, you have to have a production person, maybe even a biotech person, you find those because we help facilitate activities in the host countries. But the host countries people, there are a lot of good people over there to find in almost every country I've worked in. Trust. When you build these teams, trust. You don't go, I never go into a country and say, okay, I'm here, I'm going to solve all your problems, listen to me. That's the worst thing you can do. You build a team, you build trust, and you listen to them. They're not stupid. They know about their country many things that you don't know, no matter what you read on the internet or in National Geographic or whatever. They know it. Get to know them. They'll be your friends for life, even when your country's, your project's over, and build on that. We always like to look at connecting any kind of horticultural activity to the market, but all the research we do is science-driven. It's research that's done in replicated trials so that we know the results we get are going to be consistently obtained after the fact when we write and we train with extension bulletins and things like that. And we integrate our activities at the cropping system scale. So we develop appropriate research protocols to address the production and the marketing issues. Now, in the last few years, nutrition has come front and center. And so consumption of nutritious horticultural crops becomes much more important in any program that I've been involved in. And then you have to figure out ways to deploy these plans and transfer the technology. Economics is always important, and I'll talk about that more in a second, but no matter what program you come up with, if it's not economically viable for the producers, it's not going to be accepted. But once you develop these programs, then assess what the success could be at the local, regional, national, and maybe the global level. In the innovation labs, the old crisps, we used to talk about intercrisping. When I was in the IPM, we would intercrisp with agronomic groups and things like that because there's research that we all do that can be beneficial to other types of crops and animal systems. I think we've talked about the social issues, but the institutionalization of programs, that's just another way of me saying government buy-in, farmer buy-in, if there's extension organizations, their buy-in, because the sustainability factor becomes very important. So we like to look at any kind of our research programs as the four A's: access, affordability, availability, and adoption. What's that mean? Well, if you're working on production, then the farmer has to have access to the production inputs. If you're talking about nutrition, the food has to be accessible. Affordability, back to what I said. If it's too expensive, it's not going to happen. Availability. The AIV is a good example. AIVs are readily available in the rainy season in the eastern Africa, but not so readily available in the dry seasons or the short rainy seasons. Let's develop systems that they can be available all year long at an affordable price. And then adoption. Convince the people that are going to buy the food or buy into your production practices that it's a good thing for them to do. So I'd like to spend a few minutes on two programs. Back to the IPM CRISP project in Guatemala and Honduras, which lasted from 1992 till 2010. This was led by Virginia Tech. And I got to give a special acknowledgement to one of my favorite people, S.K. Dadada. How many know S.K.? Yeah. He's a memorable guy, and I think he lives in Davis now, doesn't he? But he's a great guy, and he led this program until his retirement. So I'll talk about that, and then I'll talk about one of our major successes in that program. And then I'll talk a little bit about the Hort Innovation Lab project on the African indigenous vegetables. So in Guatemala, this is just a schematic. We had our program, but these are all of the people that we interacted with. And that program started with what used to be called a participatory appraisal. We went into Guatemala and we learned everybody that was involved in the agricultural sector, the value chain from production all the way to market. IPM CRISP was centered on non-traditional ag export crops, horticultural crops, that were sent primarily to the U.S. And it was basically set up so that we designed integrated pest management production systems that that eliminated the use of illegal chemicals, promoted non-chemical approaches were available so that these crops could go into the U.S. and be safe and not be quarantined or embargoed and things. But during this process, this project was involved with the government of Guatemala throughout the Ministry of Agriculture, Ministry of Finance. We were involved with U.S. agencies like APHIS, EPA, FAO, International Development Bank, groups within, universities within, and their extension program, ICTA, in Guatemala, AgExport, which was a group of all the exporters that sent crops to other parts of the world, and then the private sector that supplied the supplies for production and post-harvest and things of that nature. This was a great project because through these associations, we were able to leverage additional funds to drive our program and really have a lot of success. And just a short side story, one of the ways we got a little bit closer to the Minister of Finance was his son was an undergraduate at Purdue. And when he was an undergraduate at Purdue, his father was the ambassador to the U.S. from Guatemala. He became my graduate student. And then his dad went back as a Minister of Finance. And we were able to work with the Foreign Agricultural Service on PL 480 funds and the government of Guatemala to leverage $1 million to assist in our program. We would have never been able to do that if we had just stuck with the IPM CRISP core team. And his dad protected that money for us. That's another story. But that really helped us a lot. So it was involved in trade, economic analysis of barriers to trade, small-scale growers' perceptions of the NTA market and its impacts on their livelihoods, and the IPM adoption for various households. The importance of NTAEs really provided an economic opportunity for these smallholder farmers in Guatemala to become part of the export market, have a more stable market rather than go to the night market in the center of the village and have the brokers come in, hand you a voucher and say, well, if I sell these in the U.S., I'll give you your money. Half the time, they didn't sell many of them, so they give them instead of 100% of the voucher, 10%. So we help stabilize that market. And this is important because it supplied a good off-season vegetables to the U.S. There were over 18,000 growers of snow peas just by themselves in Guatemala that we worked with. And I don't know if you know this, but 80% of the snow peas that are consumed in this U.S. in the U.S. come from Guatemala. Crops we worked on, snow peas, papaya, broccoli, star fruit, guava, and viral diseases of solanaceous crops. And I'll talk a little bit about the pre-inspection ICM, but this was a program that we developed where we developed production systems that were acceptable so that the crops could be inspected by Guatemalan inspectors, given a stamp of approval, and go right out for export, rather than the danger of being put on the ship and then being checked at the port of entry and found they had high levels of an illegal chemical or something of that nature. So we developed primarily IPM strategies that were integrated. We did a lot of cultivar testing, the pre-inspection ICM program, and this was where we really got involved with the government of Guatemala and the Ministry of Agriculture. We also looked at growing organic crops. And basically, the IPM ICM program helped us meet phytosanitary criteria of the export crops, that it was safe for consumers, it would be competitive in international markets, and it provided economic stability for these smallholder farmers. I remember the first time I went on a trip into rural Guatemala, and we went by this little farmhouse, and there was a pickup truck sitting in the driveway. And Willie Sanchez, who I worked with in Guatemala very closely, said, "Snow pea truck." What's the first thing a guy does? Buys a pickup truck. My wife says, "What do you need a pickup truck for?" I says, "To haul things." But anyways, the pre-inspection program was implemented, and 30% of the Guatemalan export production was under ICM when our program ended. I'm not sure exactly if it's increased because as the program ended, it maybe wasn't as institutionalized as we hoped. But Willie, I saw him last year when we had our meeting in Guatemala, and he said it still is in being conducted. So that's good. I'm going to skip this because I know I'm running out of a little time. But one example, in 1995, there was a snow pea crisis. And basically what happened is the U.S. government decided that snow peas coming from Guatemala were infested with an exotic species of leaf miner. So they stopped all imports into the U.S. So we worked with Virginia Tech, and they had this emergency fund under the IPM CRISP that you could use to solve special emergency problems. We were able to put together a team and survey the entire snow pea growing region of Guatemala and sample for leaf miners to see what species of leaf miners were there. And we proved that there was no exotic leaf miner species on Guatemalan snow peas, and that embargo was lifted, resulting in, approximately they had lost about $4 million because of this embargo. They recovered that money by lifting that embargo. And to us, that was one of the best showing of successes that you can think of. When it happened, the Guatemalan snow pea growers showed up on the outside the gates of the U.S. Embassy, and they threw bushel baskets of snow peas over the fence into the embassy. So it was resolved, and everybody was happy, and I think it's still a good program. And we also convinced the farmers that fungicide they were using that somebody had told them killed leaf miners didn't work, and they stopped using that chlorothalonil, because chlorothalonil was an illegal chemical. If it was detected on the snow peas, they weren't allowed into the U.S. And so we helped solve that problem too. And then a horticulture innovation lab projects. This is work that's been supported by USAID Horticulture Innovation Lab. We basically have had three projects under this. First was a one-year pilot program where we were investigating AIVs in Kenya, Western Kenya, with a group called AMPATH. It's IU Medical School, and they have started off as an HIV/AIDS clinic in Western Kenya, and it's expanded out to total health care now. But most of their patients, over 60% of them, are farmers. They came to Purdue, and they asked Purdue to help them with their agricultural system. And Jess Lohenberg-DeBoer said, "Weller, you're going to be the representative," even though I didn't volunteer. And actually, it turned out pretty well because I got to meet Beth and all these wonderful people. And so that gave us a foothold into what the AIV market might be. And then the three-year project expanded on this, where we did more research and more training. And then we're currently involved in a project that is expanding out even beyond that, where we're really looking at interventions in nutritional education for the people to build better health, better dietary diversity for the people. So this is a picture that we started off with, working with three AIVs, African nightshade, amaranth, and spider plant. We've expanded out now. We are doing some work with moringa. We're doing stuff with jute mallow, African eggplants, and the later projects. Our project areas are shown here. The project is now in Kenya, Zambia, and Tanzania. It's western Kenya, Zambia, it's north central and around Lusaka area. And then in Tanzania, we're doing work around Arusha at the present time. But we have done some work in the center of the country also. The goals establish a base of information and experience for greater production and use of indigenous vegetables and access to markets. Provide a source of food for economic development, improvement, and for food security and also nutrition. And then to improve health and nutrition by higher intake of a diverse diet. Primarily in western Kenya especially, but Zambia also and Tanzania, the staple is maize and more maize. And more maize, and a little bit of dairy, but very limited diversity. And when we've done surveys on the AIVs, you would think that since they're a rural crop and they've been historically consumed in their diets, that people would eat these quite frequently. Actually, very few people eat these every day. Only about 50% of the people say they eat it even once a week. A high percentage eat them only once a month. So we're trying to improve the consumption of these, especially for people that are ill, women, young women of childbearing age, and young children, because their diets have to be balanced, or the children don't develop well when their women are pregnant, or when they're born. There are all kinds of problems. So we're really working on introducing nutrient-dense foods such as these AIVs into their diets. So we've done household market surveys for production inputs marketing. We've evaluated germplasm, basically from the World Vegetable Center, AVRDC, which is located in Arusha, the office that we're working with. Improved production practices, and then a lot of training. And the training includes some lectures and farmer field days, but we also get farmers involved in our activities. They select the AIVs they're interested in, they plant them, we evaluate them. We've helped them with seed training because seed availability, quality seed availability is a big, big problem. So we're trying to train them to grow plants and collect the seeds from those plants, store those seeds properly, and then they have a good supply of seeds in the future. Initially, the farmers visited our research plots, looked at the various AIVs we had planted, and then they evaluated based on what they thought the plant looked like and whether they thought it was marketable, whether they thought it was attractive to their customers. And then we cooked them all up with various recipes and let them eat them. And Tebow here, he was saying, well, why don't you come up with something a little more diverse than just boiling these vegetables? We have recipes that include a variety of foods within the AIV complex that includes other vegetables, sometimes meat, sometimes dairy products and things like that. And I said this yesterday, I think, John. When I was a kid, I didn't like vegetables. I didn't think they tasted good. So our recipes really help these foods taste better. Mama Guga, who unfortunately has passed, was an AVRDC recipe developer in Tanzania. And she said she would have meetings with women and men, and she'd show these cooked dishes. And the men said, no, I won't eat it. I'm not used to that. It's not what I'm used to. She said, oh, come on, try it. So they try it. And she says, about 100% of them would come back and ask for seconds. They said, wow, I didn't know these things could taste so good. So we're working on, we are, Beth says, when's that recipe book going to be done? We're working on a recipe book. But when we do our nutritional training, we're introducing them to these various recipes. So these are just some pictures of the farmer evaluation days and the tasting. Matthew was, I should have had a picture of you in here because you were instrumental in the first tasting study that we did in our first year project. And planting, cultivar evaluation, seed training. I think basically there we're trying to use inputs that are available and affordable. We've worked a lot on chicken manure as common fertilizer. We're working on composting so they compost properly so they have good nutrition for these vegetables. We're working on irrigation. We're working on, with Tebow's working on with nets to keep insects out. When you talk to the farmers initially, they say, oh, insects, diseases, they're no problem. These plants are drought tolerant. Yeah, well, you don't grow them in the dry season, so they must not be too drought tolerant. And so we're looking at affordable yet very important inputs so that these plants can be grown more readily by the people. Impacts. We've trained a lot of people in not only production, but proper harvesting techniques and post-harvest handling. Beth will attest to the importance of post-harvest. It's especially important in a leafy vegetable because if it sits out in the sun for 10 minutes, it's going to wilt. And so we've really worked on that. We've worked on shade after harvest, harvesting at the proper time of the day, not in the heat of the day, things like that, which you think would be common knowledge, but not necessarily that way. Improved seed varieties. We're still not there, but we're getting closer. We've introduced two new varieties of amaranth and nightshade in Kenya, which will be available this year to the farmers. Market connections. We're working very hard to get these AIVs into the supermarket chain. Most of them right now are sold locally. A broker comes in or they sell them along the roadside. If we can get distribution centers, get these people grouped up a little bit better, I think we'll have a much clearer track to the market. And also this would result in good food security and nutritional security. Here's one of our farmers. She actually suffers from HIV/AIDS. She's one of the AMPATH patients. But she's become a leader in her community. People come to her, how do you grow these AIVs? Why are you making so much money? And she's one of our poster children, I guess I'll call it. She's really a very, very effective promoter of our programs. And then just briefly, the last one, improving nutrition. This is a project that's, again, supported by USAID. Rutgers is the lead institution on this, Purdue's the co-U.S. university involved. You see some of our other partners. We've done pilot surveys looking at what is needed as far as interventions go. Would people consume the AIVs if available? What kinds of inputs do they need? Things of that nature. We're doing surveys of 500 households in Kenya, 500 households in Zambia, looking at what kind of production they do, what kind of access they have, what do they eat. And we're going to then go in and 125 households each in each country, 125 will be given nutritional intervention education, 125 will be given production intervention activities, 125 in each country will be given both interventions in production and nutrition, and then we'll have a control group which will get no interventions. And after we've done these interventions, we'll track these folks for the next 2 years to see what impact we've had on changes in production, changes in consumption. We call it BCC, behavioral change communication. And we think, we're really hoping that, well, we're pretty sure, aren't we? We're going to have an impact. We're going to convince people that these crops should be an important part of their diet. And this is just, we're going to tell them what should be on their plate, why vegetables are important, and then the recipes come in. So we know from our surveys and talking with focus groups that parents, grandparents, the teachers at schools are really excited about AIVs when they understand their nutritional importance. And it's a kind of a source of pride where they say, I actually eat an indigenous crop to my country rather than this maize that, I don't know, where'd it come from? Mexico? Rather than just looking at these as wild or undeveloped crops that are eaten kind of on a whim. And I think that is an important aspect. We found out that seeds are important and other inputs are important. 75% of the farmers have trouble accessing credit. That's a big issue in all aspects of farming. A lot of these organizations that loan money to farmers want them to sign away their farm if they don't make the payment, and the farmers are very reluctant to do that. We're also working with them when they sell their crops, like if they're growing maize, many of them grow maize also. When they sell their maize, buy some of the inputs you need at the time you have money, rather than waiting until you've spent most of your money when it's time to plant the next year and you don't have money to buy the seed or you don't have money to buy the fertilizer. And we also know that about 99% of the producers know they need better practices and better technology to grow their crop better. And in the nutritional composition of the AAVs, we know the diets are a problem for adequate nutrients for women and children. Vitamin A, thiamine, a lot of the other vitamins, vitamin C, iron, calcium, zinc, big problems in the diet that they currently need. So we're characterizing these AIVs to show that they are nutrient rich, because a lot of the international guidelines for vegetables and nutrient-rich vegetables do not contain any of the AIVs. We want to get those on those lists because it's important so that people know that they are good for you. So as far as the nutrient composition, we know that the AIVs are nutrient-rich. Amaranth, spider plant, leafy nightshade, moringa, they have really high levels of the important nutrients like iron, calcium, magnesium. They have a lot of important vitamins, vitamin A, vitamin E, and many important polyphenols. We also know that if I talk to people in the U.S. and I say we're working on nightshades, they say they're poison. Right? Well, deadly nightshade's the same family, but it's a different genus and species. And we've tested all of our nightshade varieties, and the leaves are consumed. There are no alkaloids in the leaves. But when you look at the fruit, which isn't consumed, there are a lot of alkaloids. And so that's good, because we're not eating the seeds. We might save the fruit for the seeds, but we're not eating the seeds. We also know that we can select for certain lines within our different species for improvement in the nutrients. We have a new high iron amaranth. Most of the amaranths tend to be lower in iron. This one's high, so we're going to introduce that. And spider plant, I don't know how many people know about spider plant, but it will flower within a month of emerging. And once it flowers, you're done harvesting the leaves. We have selected a spider plant variety that doesn't flower for up to 6 months, so it expands the production and the harvesting period for that particular crop. And then we're also looking not only at the rural populations, but the peri-urban and the urban populations. We introduced these things called sack gardens, or a gunny sack full of compost, that where you don't have a lot of land, you can still grow some vegetables as long as you have water and availability of seeds. So in these urban areas, some of these have been accepted. That helps them with their diet. We're also working with a street boys school that's part of AMPATH. These are kids that wander the streets. They're at the farm. They're at the school. They're getting educated, and we've become involved in the farm that's there, training them, and hopefully we'll be training some of them to be young farmers of the future. Even in Africa, the average farming age is not 35. It's 50, 55. It's not a whole lot different than the U.S. We need to show young people that farming is an attractive occupation. They can enjoy it. They can be happy. They can make money. They might even have some free time. And that's what we're looking for. So we want to link youth with our projects. So I think I've taken up enough of your time, but I think you got the key takeaways that these AIVs can have a dramatic impact in the farming system, in the nutritional aspects, income, and allowing children not to stop going to school after sixth grade, get an education, but that farming can be attractive. This is just a list of most of the people from Purdue, Rutgers, Kenya, Tanzania, Zambia that have been involved. But I want to give special recognition to Beth Mitchum, Aaron McGuire, Archie Jarman. They're great. If you've never met Beth, meet her. She's fantastic. It's a wonderful organization to work with. USAID, John Bowman. John, stand up so everybody sees you. He is great. He's supportive, and he's the voice of horticulture at USAID, and we thank you, John. And in the missions, when you're involved in work like this, go to the missions. Sometimes it's hard to get in, but once you get in and once they get to know you, you can become friendly with them, and you find out opportunities. One thing, a lesson, you never go in there and ask them for money. Right, John? But when you have good discussions with them about your project and everything, they give you ideas of how you can become further connected with a lot of the programs that they're doing. And then one last thing. Traveling internationally allows you to take certain things off your bucket list. I never thought I'd see Victoria Falls. How many of you have seen Victoria Falls? Raise your hands high. Great, huh? Fantastic. Yes. And I got to take a trip with my sons to southern Zambia where we rode elephants. We played with lions. We played with cheetahs. Cheetahs love to have their ears rubbed. Lions do not. And baby zebras. It's fantastic. So thank you very much for your attention. I hope it was somewhat interesting, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if we had time. I tell you, one last thing I'd like to say. People in the world, 99% of people in the world are the same. They're all good people, probably 99.9%. They all want a good life. They want a better life. They want to look at opportunities. And that's the one thing you learn really quick in international work is it's great to meet these people. It's very fulfilling to try to help them in any way possible. But the interactions are just fantastic.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Quite a long list of countries and projects and impact of what you have done around the world. Really, at this point, I would like to open the floor. Any quick question for Steve? Do we have the time for that?
John. Okay, the question is, why aren't more commercial seed companies interested in marketing AIV seeds? I think the big challenge is they don't understand the AIV system. They don't see any economic gain by starting to sell a wider variety of these seed. And so the challenge there is to convince them that there is a market. And that's where we have to convince our farmers that rather than going to the market and buying a pint jar of so-called amaranth seed is not good for them because half of it doesn't germinate, that they should start thinking of a commercial variety. So I think it becomes an educational process right along the lines, but we gotta do a good job of talking to the seed companies to get them interested. And in lieu of that, until we can do that, we're training our farmers that we can give them these AVRDC seed lines that they like. And CalRO has a seed physiologist that works with us to show them how to grow them so they can produce the seed, when to harvest the seed when it's mature, how to handle the seed in processing it, and how to store the seed so that it's viable when the time comes to plant it. So that's one thing we're doing to try to get around that. The other thing is that we have gotten now in Kenya four of the AIV lines, two amaranth and two nightshade, approved by the Guatemalan government for sale. And some of the seed companies, they don't do any seed testing for AIVs, so we can now introduce those, and if we can introduce those, and those are the types that the farmers want to buy, I think that'll help the process. But it's going to take a little bit of time. It's a big challenge. But and also, the commercial seeds tend to be a little more expensive. And they're not used to buying seed that costs very much. Yes and no. I think what we have to do with any of these indigenous crops, and that goes back to our market-driven approach, before you think about introducing any crop, you have to look at the market. Is there a market for it? And if it appears there is a market, then you have to determine how do you grow this crop in a way that if it gets to the market, it would be affordable. But it's like any new introduction to people that aren't familiar with a particular crop. How many new crops have been introduced in our lifetime? I don't know. Kiwi? What else? Pomegranate? Huh? Dragon fruit? But it takes a lot of work and a lot of education to do that. So our initial movement in Eastern Africa is, well, in our surveys, we know that in the surveyed populations, the awareness of these crops is there. As far as, yes, we know about amaranth. Yes, we know about nightshade. Yes, we know about spider plant. What they don't know many times is these things are really good for you. And they also don't know how do you produce them, you know, with the right recipe so that I will enjoy it. And so I think it goes to the nutritional education. Let's look at what, you know, one slide I had the plate. What should be on that plate so that you're healthy? And you also educate them about a healthy diet. And we're also trying to educate them because you're seeing a real influx of the so-called Western diet. The supermarkets are jumping up all over. And if you look at the supermarkets and what they sell, they're selling what they sell here, whatever the Safeway is or whatever it is here. And so it's kind of a big picture approach. But I think we have to start locally. And then one thing I found interesting, we're working with a company, Mace Foods in Kenya. They dry these AIVs, they package them up, and they sell them in Europe, and they also sell some in the U.S. And I was on an airplane the other day, and you know these Kind bars? They have amaranth in them. And pretzels, on a Delta flight I was on, amaranth was one of the components in the... So I think we also have to look at, could we build an international market for these crops outside of Kenya, Tanzania, and Zambia? I don't know if I answered your question, but I think we start locally and we expand from there. So if you create a local market, then the international market may develop because, you know, people come to Kenya, they say, what's this on my plate? It's amaranth. Ooh, it tastes good. Why don't I have that in the U.S.? Yeah, well, my observation in the countries in Eastern Africa, a lot of the small family farms, they have what they call a kitchen garden. And they grow a lot of these types of things. And then the wife will use that in the preparation of the meals and things of that nature. And sometimes they sell a few of those on the side. And it's not a major income flow, but it's very common. The other thing, the approach that AVRDC is pushing to a certain degree is these school gardens. And the idea there, in my mind, is they're trying to educate, they're trying to provide nutritional and farming education to the kids. It's sort of that concept of the land-grant institution in the U.S., to me, on a very small scale. Send the kids to the land-grant college so they can come back with the technology to make the farm more efficient. And I think there can be some overflow into that particular system. So I think all of that's going on. As far as, I guess, you're asking me, is USAID pushing the three different types of approaches? I know there's some pressure, not pressure, there's some thought that I've heard, why don't you guys do a little bit more with the urban, peri-urban population as far as providing them with ways that they could grow some of these crops? And this can be especially important in the urban slums, which there's plenty of those in some of these cities near where we work. Sack gardens is a possibility and things like that. It's not going to make them economically viable, but some of these people have absolutely no income, and I know some of them that have the sack gardens actually sell a few of these vegetables on the local market. So I think there's bits and pieces of all that going on. Where's it headed? I think in Kenya, we have an advantage working with AMPATH because of HIV/AIDS, and which really was a big major problem. Groups became present. It wasn't just a farmer. It was groups of farmers. And I think where we have groups of farmers, it's kind of a loose co-op that they work together. And so those types of groups we're working with, trying to get certain people within that group to be the seed producer, certain people to be the production leader, certain people to be the harvesting and the marketing aspects of it. And the other interesting thing about some of these groups in Kenya, they've organized what's called GISA, Group Investment Savings Associations. And so you got a group of 20 people, they all pay a certain amount of their income into this bank, that's their bank, and then they give loans to each other, their interest-bearing loans, that are expected to be paid back. And when they're not paid back, there's a lot of group pressure on the people that don't pay back, and they eventually do pay back. And so it's a self-governing financial institution that has helped them have access to the finances to be able to buy some of these inputs. And so I think if you're trying to make a more generate more income, these groups are what's going to do that. The smaller scale kitchen gardens and school gardens, I think the school gardens have some potential from the standpoint of raising awareness of where your food comes from. I mean, I don't know how many of you, well, I don't have kids in grade school anymore, but I was always appalled in biology classes. They never talked about plants. They never mentioned agriculture. So I think that's good. Didn't answer your question, but I'm not going to say USAID projects ever fail.
Okay. Before we get on the last item of our agenda, I would just like to give one more round for Steve.
Thank you, too.
Please don't go too far, because I need you again for the last item on the agenda. Here, Steve.